This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a real pleasure to have back in the studio with me Chip Burleigh, one of the most astute observers of the far right in America. Chip Burleigh is senior analyst at Political Research Associates in the Boston area. He's the co-author of several books and many, many articles. One of his books, Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort. Chip Burleigh, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Hey, Matt. Good to be back.
It's great to have you back. When we were walking over here to the studio, you used a phrase that is sticking in my mind. You said we're in the midst of the mainstreaming of hate. What did you mean by that?
Well, there's always people hanging around in the corners saying, you know, slurs against people of color or immigrants or people who are different from them. And that's the norm in a society. And in a democratic society, that's part of the price you pay. But when major political or religious figures stand up and start to spout demonstrably false slurs against whole groups of people based on their religion or race, then something has shifted in the society that's very, very harmful and corrosive, and to have silence for the most part rather than a pushback by a lot of the other leaders in the country shows that they're cowardly and they're not going to stand up, and they lack the backbone that a good democratic society needs.
So what leaders are you referring to here? I mean, the mainstream Republican leaders, Newt Gingrich, Sarah Palin, is that who you're referring to?
And people like Bill Bennett as well, and intellectuals on the right and media people at Fox News. And there's a whole raft of people now who have stepped over the line of criticism over political ideas and are demonizing primarily Muslims and Mexican immigrants, but also a range of other people under this banner that somehow socialist, secular, humanist liberals are out to destroy America.
And the anti-Muslim sentiment is the cheapest one for people to kind of buy right now. I mean, and it's not just Newt Gingrich and Bennett and Sarah Palin and Fox. I mean, we had Marty Peretz, the editor of the New Republic, with a really vile anti-Muslim comment that he only partially retracted when he was referring to their not deserving First Amendment rights. He said that offends his principles in behalf of the First Amendment, but not his principles against prejudice, which he doesn't seem to be having. And then there's also, I mean, on the mosque, the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, I mean, there was Howard Dean, who's usually pretty good on a lot of issues, saying it shouldn't be there, or Harry Reid.
Right. And you have the leadership of the Jewish community in this arena, the Anti-Defamation League, with Abraham Foxman chiming in and saying they shouldn't build the mosque. This is an organization that was founded not just to defend the rights and the honor of Jews, but to push forward a human rights agenda. And it betrayed it when it said that the mosque should not be built. So it's horrifying when political people do it. It's even more horrifying when human rights groups do it.
Yeah, I mean, the ADL is supposed to be opposed to discrimination everywhere and for freedom of religion everywhere, and both of those things it violated with its position. It must have gotten a lot of negative feedback for that, didn't it?
Oh, it did. It got a lot of negative feedback within its own membership and within its own constituency, and good. It's good that there was that pushback.
Where is this going to go, do you think?
Well, you know, it only can go, you know, dialectically speaking, it can only go in two directions. It can get worse or it can get better. There is no stasis. So I think it's going to get worse for a while. It's pretty clear the Republicans have decided that they can get more energy and more recruitment and more mobilization for the November election by, as you put it in an article in The Progressive, ginning up this fear and anger. And so far, that seems to be the strategy. And so it'll get worse.
It's odd. I see statistics that seem to be proving that the Republicans are doing a smart strategy if that's their only goal and they don't care about tearing apart the fabric of the country in an effort to seize power, which evidently they don't care about. But it seems to be working because white working class and lower to middle class voters are trending Republican in enormous numbers now, twice as much as usual. And also, on the flip side, even Latino voters don't seem to be wanting to or getting out to the polls are saying they're going to get out to the polls in numbers that they used to. So the people that they're dumping on aren't responding, some of them, and the people they're appealing to are taking the bait.
Well, they're taking the bait, and the Democrats don't seem to have responded with any kind of message that makes young people, people of color, Mexican Americans, they don't seem believable. They put out a pitch and people just don't believe it. The people who helped elect Obama just look at the rhetoric of the Democratic Leadership Council kind of mentality that surrounded Obama and they go, we don't buy it. And the Republicans are using the age-old tactic of promoting fear to get people to the polls. And in this moment where there's a huge Tea Party, yes, it started as AstroTurf, but it's become a real social movement. You have essentially this classic right-wing populist formula where the angry white middle class shakes its fist at the elites up above, but it can't really reach them. So it stomps on the people down below. And this is something that goes way back in America, all the way back to rebellions against the federal government that were ended up targeted at Native people.
I'm speaking with Chip Berlay, Chip Berlay of Political Research Associates. In my opinion, the most astute observer of the far right in the United States and has been for many years now. You just mentioned that the Tea Party movement is an actual, genuine social movement. That's hard for a lot of people on the left to accept because it's so much easier to read Jane Mayer's article in The New Yorker and say, look at the Koch brothers, they funded this thing. Look at Dick Armey, he's been behind it. Look at Fox, they were pulling the strings, and they're just puppets down below at the grassroots. It's not really a grassroots movement. What's wrong with that?
Well, it's because the sociologists are studying it as a grassroots movement and recognizing that it was developed as AstroTurf. It was funded by people like the Koch brothers. But that doesn't mean there isn't actually now a series of overlapping movements that are autonomous that really are negotiating now with the Republican Party for political power. And so it's a mistake to just say, oh, you know, It's just AstroTurf, so we don't have to worry about it. I don't get the analogy. And you can look at the polls and the statistical work that's being done, and there's large numbers of people involved. They're very mobilized. They have a series of somewhat contradictory frames around economic libertarianism, but they're also worried about immigration. They're worried about Muslims. They're worried about abortion. They're worried about gay rights. And there's a lot of distortion of the polling. The Democrats say, oh, these people are overwhelmingly wealthy. Well, if you actually look at the statistical breakdown, the top third, you know, has a little more money than most Americans. But there's, you know, a large number of people who earn less than $50,000 a year, and there's a group of people who earn less than $30,000. So this is a white middle class and working class movement.
Yeah, I mean, I went out on April 15th of 2010 in Madison, Wisconsin, the Capitol, where they were busing in, where, you know, busloads of people came in. And there must have been, I think, 4,000 or 5,000 people there. And I got my reporter's pad out and did my little reporting thing and talked to 30, 40, 50 people. And, you know, it wasn't like they had strings attached that went straight to the Koch brothers. I mean, these people came because the message that was emanating out of the Tea Party movement appealed to them. And they were there either regurgitating that or to be less condescending, you know, expressing their own grievances. I do think they were contradictory, as you said. And there is an oddity about the Tea Party movement, Chip Berlay, in the issues that they seized upon. And in a way, you anticipated the Tea Party movement when you wrote in The Progressive that there was going to be this backlash against Obama. I think it was in our February 2009 issue, shortly after inauguration, you said, look, a lot of people aren't comfortable with a black man in the White House, and there are grievances among, you know, the white middle class, working class, and there are these forces on the far right egging people on, and they could seize on any number of issues, and including in that list, you had health care. And I thought that was an amazing prophecy because I almost took that out, actually, as the editor, because it's healthcare. What the hell does healthcare have to do with all this other stuff? Because, you know, in the list was anti-immigrant stuff, which was pretty obvious that they might seize on. But healthcare, I mean, healthcare was so irrational to me because, you know, why would they oppose healthcare? You know, do they not want their kids, if their kids are ill, to get healthcare? So what was that about? Why was the healthcare issue seized on?
Well, it's because of this really deep and long-standing argument by libertarian economic figures like, Road to Serfdom by Friedrich von Hayek, and the work of von Mises, who Reagan just thought was wonderful, and Milton Friedman. And this whole idea is that anything that is communal and builds a government social safety net is something that will lead inevitably towards totalitarianism, which is fascism and socialism, which means Obama is both Hitler and Stalin. Now, that seems pretty irrational, and, you know, I'm raising my hand here. Yeah, it's pretty irrational. But it's a very widespread belief, and it's been kept alive by groups like the John Birch Society, which has not gone away since the late 50s when it was founded.
I mean, this seems to be the biggest right-wing social movement since the Birchers that we're seeing now. There may have been others. You're the expert, not me, but it does remind me of that kind of grassroots appeal that the Birchers had. And another – well, do you think that's just wrong? Let's just see what you think.
No, that's right. I think, you know, you look at large right-wing mass revolts, and one would be pro-segregation, anti-civil rights, and then the other would be the kind of Bircher mentality, which is more of an elite formation that had grassroots support. Mm-hmm.
The other one other oddity about the Tea Party movement is this so-called "Don't Tread on Me." I mean, that's their symbol, that's their flag, that's on a lot of those posters on April 15th when I was talking to people, and yet there wasn't "Don't Tread on Me" when Bush was treading on them. You know, when George W. Bush was passing the Patriot Act and doing NSA spying and basically trampling all over the Constitution. It's that inconsistency that makes a lot of observers like me just kind of raise my eyebrows and say, you know, what is this group? How do you explain that contradiction?
Well, during the last Bush administration, there actually was a revolt among sort of the Birch crowd, the Phyllis Schlafly's, the Jerome Corsi's, the people like that. And they were arguing that Bush was selling out the country to a global UN plot to build a new world order through the North American Union. And that's when it dawned on me that something was amiss, that we were starting to see the kind of rhetoric that led to the militia movement in the 1990s. So I wrote a report called Toxic to Democracy back in 2008 that said something's going on here with these theories popping up on the right. And I think actually the organizing that went on there didn't reach the level of major Republican Party figures, but it was there in the background. So on the one hand, there was not an organized, obvious push against Republican leadership and George Bush, but there was something brewing. And then when Obama was elected, it was very easy to expand that. And I think that there is a hypocrisy there, but so what? I mean, people are hypocritical and do contradictory things all the time.
And the Tea Party has, you know, different colorations too. I mean, the people I saw in Madison, Wisconsin, most of them weren't real fire-breathing and scary. And yet you've visited other right-wing or studied other right-wing movements out in Montana and Idaho, where I imagine the gathering might be a little more closely kind of aligned with maybe even Aryan Nation stuff. I mean, what are the overlaps here?
Well, when you have a large right-wing populist movement, on the one hand, the Republican Party is desperately trying to get their attention and move their energy into the electoral system. But on the other side, you have these militant white supremacists and other revolutionary right groups trying to recruit them further into militancy and into open revolt. And so that's a dynamic that goes on, and it's very much dependent on the state in which it's happening. So that in Montana, for instance, there's much more recruitment by white supremacists trying to pull people into the Tea Party way to the right, but which is exactly the dynamic that led to Timothy McVeigh blowing up the federal building in 1995. He was a neo-Nazi who had moved out of the militia movement into a neo-Nazi movement, and he was blowing up the federal building to get the militia movement to move towards open insurrection. And that's the dynamic here that people should be aware of. It's not just individual acts of hate, but the idea that there could be a propaganda of the deed to move people to the right and to insurrection.
I'm speaking with Chip Berlay, senior analyst at Political Research Associates. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. How would a propaganda of the deed work, succeed? Why would people seeing such a thing as Timothy McVeigh's building explosion and all the people dead say, wow, we want more of that? That's where I'm at.
Well, it didn't work with McVeigh. It didn't work with the Weather Underground. Revolutionaries often take their own romantic, heroic ideas of themselves as change agents and misinterpret how much people are going to pay attention to them. So that essentially, McVeigh's act galvanized the militia movement to reject it. And it actually changed the dynamic of the militia movement in the opposite direction that he wanted. So that, no, it probably wouldn't work, but it doesn't mean that this kind of social dynamic of xenophobia and anger and fear isn't being mobilized. And I think it's important to see the dynamic here between fear, economic fear of being displaced, and gender and race. And so it's not just about race with Obama and the changing demographic, but it's also about men wanting to keep control of a gender hierarchy, and which is why they're against abortion and gay rights. And there's actually new research old research recently republished by Rory McVeigh, who's a sociologist, who says, look, right-wing movements are all about defending unequal power and privilege. And it's when people in white movements see themselves losing power in one of three arenas that these large movements form, and they're political, economic, and social.
How should progressives, or how should have Obama addressed the legitimate economic grievances of the people in this country? I mean, my opinion is that Obama didn't do nearly enough to give people a tangible reason to say, yeah, you're going in the right direction, you're helping me out. I mean, he didn't come out with a moratorium on foreclosures, for instance, which even Hillary Clinton had proposed during the campaign, and his stimulus package was not nearly as much as he was warned early on.
Well, you know, you're a president. You get elected by a group of people out in the country voting for you, and you arrive in Washington, and you're immediately surrounded by the permanent party superstructure and professional political operatives, and it's as if you've been abducted. And so there has been a battle within the Obama administration between sort of the Rahm Emanuels and the David Axelrods of the world. And David Axelrod obviously advising him to use populist rhetoric and say, you know, not things like, you know, I understand you have pain. He needs to say things like, yeah, you got screwed. A lot of you got screwed, and we're going to do something about it. You don't pontificate in these highfalutin, you know, peacemaking tones about we all have to work this out together. People are angry, and they have every right to be angry. I was horrified that he bailed out bankers who were able to buy their second yachts, you know, so that people in Iowa could have their homes foreclosed on. What brainless dweeb in the Democratic Party came up with that idea?
Well, it's interesting because Barney Frank was suggesting, you know, you got to get some concessions from those banks, which was logical. The banks would have been out of business. The CEOs were lost, you know, millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. And it was Obama had tremendous leverage at that point. But it was interesting. I read in Jonathan Alter's book that it was Timothy Geithner and Larry Summers who said, you love this. Don't kick the banks when they're down.
Yeah, right. Thank you. It's a perfect time to kick them.
and that prevailed. Now, you said it's like Obama's been abducted when he got to Washington. I want to follow up on that, Chip Berlay, because I can't tell you how many people have asked me after Obama came in and disappointed so many people, you know, did they take him into a room and tell him that if he did X, Y, or Z, you know, remember the Kennedy assassination? How do you respond to people who think that's how it works?
Well, that's not how it works. And it's pretty clear from the complex political science studies that are done about how, you know, the messy process, the kind of back of the yard slaughterhouse process of actual political and electoral and legislative work in Washington, D.C., that there were battles and certain forces, you know, win over the power structure of any administration at any given moment. And this can shift. But this idea of vast conspiracies controlling America is, you know, it's a way of saying we can't do anything because these people are so powerful and the conspiracy is so deep that, you know, it's pointless. And so conspiracy theories disarm people, essentially, right, and they make us not want to organize. I'll turn it around. The AFL-CIO has launched a project called Working America, which puts people in the field knocking on doors. So you can sit around bemoaning the fact that, you know, the Rockefeller Illuminati conspiracy has abducted Obama, or you can get off your ass and knock on doors and go to meetings and write letters and do something. The choice is yours.
I mean, it is possible that Obama, you know, could have followed more of David Axelrod than he did of Rahm Emanuel. It is possible that, you know, we could have had a bigger social movement out there pushing him, and that we could have, you know, swarmed those healthcare open town meetings in August of 2009 rather than letting some of the other people in there. I almost called them nuts, but I resisted because you have, Chipperley, warned against derisive name-calling of some of these people on the far right, calling them nuts or crackpots or extremists, you say, isn't helpful or is counterproductive. Explain that.
Well, you know, I spent quite over a decade as a community and labor organizer, and you don't knock on a door in a white working class neighborhood if you're fighting against, you know, pro-segregation forces, and say, you racist swine, you idiot, don't you realize that you're just expressing the frustrations of racial-based hierarchies which don't exist? Abandon the white race. Well, I mean, you know, as, you know, if you can pick yourself off the sidewalk where you've just been punched, you don't have a next line. So I understand that some of these claims are pretty, you know, far-fetched. But if you're organizing, you have to start out by listening and then talking to people respectfully. Even if you don't respect their ideas, you have to model the behavior as an organizer of being a respectful part of a community. So I understand that it's fun to make fun of these folks, and it's easy to trivialize what they say. But if you really want to – and I'm not suggesting people say, oh, you know, Burleigh is an idiot for saying we should go organize the Tea Party people. Well, of course you'd be an idiot to go organize people already active in the Tea Party movement. I'm saying that there are hundreds of thousands of white working class and middle class people who are swing voters, who are people who could join movements for a progressive single-payer health care bill. There are people who are duck hunters for environmental issues. You need to understand these people are angry and talk to them about a different solution. And you can't do that by starting out saying, you're stupid and you're crazy. And there's no social science data that people who join right-wing movements are any more stupid or crazy than the rest of us.
You also made a point in an article in The Progressive that by calling them extremists, you are kind of giving cover to those people who say there's a very narrow center where all sensible, rational, intelligent people should remain.
Right. Well, I mean, it's not a good idea to use the word extremist, because the word extremist is used by the political center to say, pay no attention to dissent on the left or right. So when people on the left talk about the right wing as extremist, we're reinforcing the idea that people with radical ideas for social and economic change are people who don't belong in the political debate. So it's very self-defeating rhetoric.
Yeah, I've heard a lot on some progressive radio stations, actually, some of the hosts or some of the guests saying, oh, you know, those people, Sharon Engel, Sarah Palin, they're radicals. And so when my predecessor, Erwin Old, is, you know, he couldn't be called anything nicer than a radical.
Exactly.
He hated being called a liberal, and even though he was editing the Progressive magazine, I don't even think he liked being called a progressive. You know, he wanted to be called a radical. So I do think you've got a point there. I'm speaking with Chipperley. He's the senior analyst at Political Research Associates in the Boston area. He is the author of Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort. He wrote that many years ago. It's a lot closer now than it was back then.
Unfortunately, prophetic.
Tell me, let's talk about the F word for a little bit. Noam Chomsky has been talking about the risk of fascism coming to the United States. I heard him speak in Madison in the spring of 2010, and then I followed up with a cover story in The Progressive examining that possibility. I'd been resistant for many years to the idea, and again, a lot of people on the progressive side want to claim it, that we're already a fascist country. What's wrong with that?
Well, in a fascist country, we wouldn't have a radio program being broadcast with you and me talking. So it's kind of the proof that it's not fascism is that dissent is allowed. In fascist societies, there is no dissent. It's crushed. So let's be clear that there are neo-fascist currents in a lot of societies. They tend to be very repressive, and they don't allow dissent. But the current political theorizing among scholars of fascism is that fascism is the most militant form of right-wing populist nationalism. So when you have a large right-wing populist movement, you have to say, what are the potentials of it moving towards fascism? Because right-wing populism is a core element of fascism. But most right-wing populist movements never move towards fascism because they don't have to. So in the Weimar period, you had a very strong left and a very strong right. And so you basically had a power contest. So the question is, when Noam Chomsky talks about Weimar, is he talking about 1928 or 1932? And so we can't dismiss a discussion of fascism when you look at right-wing populist movements. But in 1928, there was still a chance for the left to make a move and take more power. And so I think when Chomsky talks about fascism and the center cannot hold, it's that Yeats poem about the Worcester full of passionate intensity. And I think he's saying, if you don't want to keep moving to the right, you need, as a left, to stand up across all of our divisions and really push back, because our moment is now to try and recruit some of these people who are angry towards a more progressive analysis.
Chipper Lee, I want to follow up on this question of right-wing. There is a mass right-wing movement in this country. We haven't talked about the nationalist aspect of it, and this is a question among some observers who claim that the Tea Party movement isn't proto-fascist or neo-fascist because it's libertarian. And yet, when I was at that Tea Party rally, you know, there were a few people expressing real libertarian views, but there was a lot of USA, USA, USA going on. So to me, that doesn't sound so libertarian as it does nationalistic. To what extent is this libertarianism maybe surface and the nationalism, which is even more troubling in combination, looming right below the surface?
I think the libertarianism is a current in the Tea Party movement. It is what the Tea Party Inc. people, as Adele Stan and Nestor Kaplan talk about in their articles, and Sarah Posner, other people who write about the right. So the elite formations want you to pay attention to the libertarian economic theories, but the people in the street are very white nationalist, as Lenny Zeskin likes to point out, and he's right. This is a white nationalist movement. It's a movement of resentment, and its anger is being focused in a way that is going to be harmful to groups of people. So yes, it's a combination of things, but don't be fooled by the banner of libertarianism when this is an angry white nationalist movement.
And it's an angry white nationalist Christian movement.
Largely.
I was at this rally I was at, a speaker was saying, leading the crowd in, who's our leader? And the answer was Jesus. And that was a call and response, who's our leader? Jesus. And you've studied these right-wing Christian movements too, and to what extent are they funneling energy into this Tea Party movement?
Well, there's an annual conference called the Values Voter Summit, and last year they actually had a panel discussion in a workshop on the Tea Party movement, where the frame of that panel was that this was a Christian movement of revivalism. And what you have now is a very large sector of the Christian right involved in the Tea Party movement. And what we don't know is how many new people are being brought into the political square and into the voting pool. There are a whole range of people. So definitely the libertarianism is a cover for the white nationalism and the Christian right involvement.
Well, those are things we're going to have to watch out for, and we do need to go out and knock on those doors and try to convince some people who may want to drift that way that, you know, there's a better home, a nicer home, a more accepting home here on the other side that is more in tune with the best values of this country rather than something really, really scary. Chip Berlay has been my guest today. Chip Berlay is senior analyst at Political Research Associates. Chip Berlay, thanks for being my guest.
Oh, thanks, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.